The next case this morning is 20-2018, Hendrickson versus AFS CME Council 18. Council, please prepare to argue.
Morning, Your Honor.
Good morning.
Thank you. Brian Kelsey on behalf of plaintiff appellant Brett Hendrickson, and may it please the court. This case really turns on one sentence. To give your consent, you have to know what you're consenting to. To give your consent, you have to know what it is that you're consenting to. And in Janus versus AFSCME in 2018, the Supreme Court said that non-union members must give their affirmative consent to waive their constitutional right to pay nothing to the union. Hendrickson never did that. Instead, Hendrickson was given an unconstitutional choice between paying union dues or paying 87% of that amount.
Well, counsel, how is there any lack of consent or mutual mistake at the time that Mr. Hendrickson signed the membership agreement three times, given that Abood was the governing law at that time?
Judge Matheson, that's a good question, and I think you're exactly right. The question is, at that time, did he give his affirmative consent? And the question is also, what did he give his affirmative consent to? He certainly gave his affirmative consent, given those circumstances, to have those union dues taken out. What he did not give is what is required by Janus, and that is affirmative consent to waive his constitutional right to pay nothing to the union.
Wait a minute, counsel. Why should he be able to void his membership post-Janus based on a change to the law that didn't make the contract itself illegal, but might have affected his decision to enter the contract in the first place?
Because that is the law of the circuit as well. Under the
what's your authority for that?
Yes, that is the U.S. versus Bunner case.
Say that again. U.S. v. what?
Versus Bunner, B-U-N-N-E-R.
All right.
And that's a 10th Circuit case from 1998. And in that case, it said that there was an intervening United States Supreme Court decision. And that stands for the proposition that that subsequent decision constitutes a mistake of law that allows the party to reopen that agreement to choose one option versus another.
Is this the plea agreement case? And in that case, it frustrated the entire purpose of the plea agreement because the government traded a plea for one crime and dropped the other things in the indictment. And the whole point of it was to have him plead guilty to a crime. And once the court decided there was no crime at all, it completely frustrated the purpose of the contract. But here, it doesn't frustrate the purpose of the contract. He agreed, he entered into three times to be a member of the union and to have the benefits of that bargain. In the plea agreement case, the federal government and the defendant both lost what they were bargaining for. So I don't think that case helps you.
Well, I appreciate that view, Your Honor, but I think that the correct analogy in that case is between Hendrickson and the prosecutor. And in that case, it was the prosecutor who did voluntarily agree to not prosecute on those three other crimes, those three other causes of action.
In exchange for a guilty plea to another crime. So the benefit of his bargain was completely frustrated because what the defendant pleaded to was not a crime. Here, the benefit of the bargain, the contract, was I pay union dues, I get services from the union. Nothing about Janus speaks to a union member who voluntarily enters into a union contract. Nothing about Janus frustrates the purpose of that agreement.
Well, and I would respectfully say that the alternative in that Bunner case was ruled unconstitutional, just like in this case, the alternative was for Mr. Hendrickson was to pay 87% of union dues. That is no longer the alternative. The alternative that is the law of the land under Janus now is that he gets to pay $0 to the union.
But in Bunner, the intervening case invalidated the crime. Here, nothing about Janus speaks to whether someone who voluntarily becomes a member of a union it doesn't invalidate that. It doesn't even speak to that. It only talks about charging dues to non-union members.
Your Honor, the union case, it does argue that Janus applies to non-union members, but, and that's because Janus himself was a non-member. But that's not all that the case says. It says, quote, employees must clearly and affirmatively give their consent. So the Janus decision applies to all government employees at the time that they're presented with the decision whether to join. And it sets forth the criteria by which someone can move from being a non-member to a member.
Counsel, let me just make sure if I'm understanding your argument correctly. If you turn the clock back to when Mr. Hendrickson signed his membership dues deduction authorization three times, if Janus had been decided at that time, it would have changed his calculus, I suppose. Is that if your argument is he might have thought about joining the union differently? Is that basically your argument?
That's exactly the argument, Your Honor. Because
and again, I'm just not understanding how the plea agreement cases get you there.
Well, those cases state that when an intervening U.S. Supreme Court decision rules that one of the two options is unconstitutional, then that bargain is reopened and you can choose the other option and that agreement is foreclosed. Just like the prosecutor no longer had to stand by his agreement not to prosecute on the other three crimes. In this case, Mr. Hendrickson no longer has to stand by his decision to pay 100% of union dues. And in fact, the facts, we did not harp on this point because I don't think it's necessary in our briefings, but the facts show that we actually pled coercion the first time that he signed his union card back in 2007. He had left the Department of Human Services. He had gone to a different department that was not covered by AFSCME. He came back to the Department of Human Services, and for 6 months, he did not pay a dime, even of agency fees. And if that is when the union approached him with this unconstitutional choice, he's of limited means as a state employee. He couldn't afford to pay the full 6 months of back agency fees at that time. He felt coerced into making the decision to choose to pay the full union dues at that time. And that is when the unconstitutional waiver to pay nothing was never given to him. So the Janus decision even says on this very point, it says, quote, by agreeing to pay, non-members are waiving their First Amendment rights, and such a waiver cannot be presumed. So that sentence cannot be talking about Janus himself because he never agreed to pay anything. It's talking about non-members like Hendrickson used to be back in 2007. And it says that when he does agree to pay, he can only do so by waiving his First Amendment right. And he's never been able to do that. That may be possible going forward, Your Honors, certainly. But it was
by signing at the time. By signing the agreement, which he did he become a union member?
According to the laws that were in place at
according
the time.
According to the agreement.
According to the terms of the agreement, which is unconstitutional now, yes, he did.
I understand. I understand your argument. But he became a union member. Had he been a union member prior to signing the agreement?
He had not. As is the case with all union members, they're not born union members. They have to become union members. And the Janus decision describes the criteria by which they become so.
Had he previously been a union member?
Originally, the Department of Human Services, when he was first hired, was actually not covered by a collective bargaining agreement. So he was not originally.
In previous years, had he been a union member?
As I mentioned before, he started paying those union dues back then.
I don't want you to see me as hostile to you. I'm just trying to find out to understand your case, right, whether he had been a union member at any time prior to becoming a union member pursuant to the terms of this agreement.
Well, as Judge Matheson said, he signed the agreement. The first one, I believe, was back in 2007, and there were two subsequent agreements.
All right. So the answer is yes. He had, by virtue of those two previous agreements, he had been a member.
That's right, Your Honor. And that's why I'm harping on this, the 2007 decision.
And I'm harping on the language of the Supreme Court that talks about members and non-union members and trying to determine the status in which your client fits.
Right. And I wouldn't say it. The Janus decision is very clear. It applies to employees. That's the word it uses. Employees must give affirmative consent.
An affirmative consent by employees when I sign an agreement that says I hereby join the union and authorize you to deduct union dues from my pay. I mean, isn't that an affirmative consent?
It is, Your Honor, an affirmative consent based on an unconstitutional choice that was given to him. And so with that, Your Honors, I would prefer to...
Counsel, I need to ask you another question concerning your exclusive representation issue. And that is, this is your ability to sue the governor and the attorney general. The New Mexico Supreme Court has said that the PELRB must remain free from the executive's control or coercive influence. Doesn't that mean that the governor and the attorney general are not proper ex parte young parties, and that you should at least have sued members of the PELRB in addition to them?
Well, first of all, Your Honor, I just would like to point out that you are correct that the district court only applied this ex parte Young analysis to the second claim for exclusive representation, yes, and not the first claim. That was not entirely clear from the briefing. But in that instance, the reason why the governor and the attorney general are the proper parties, because the issue is not whether the Public Employee Relations Board, Labor Relations Board, not whether those laws that they're applying, it's not whether they were being properly applied, but rather it's whether they were constitutional in the first place. And that's why under the case of Petrella versus Brownback from this court, the attorney general and the governor are the proper defendants when the constitutionality of that statute is called into question. And with that—
All right, you wanted to reserve the rest of your time, so it's reserved.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. All right. Counsel, we're ready to hear from you.
May it please the court, Eileen Goldsmith for AFSCME Council 18. I'm sharing time with counsel for the state defendants, and I'll turn it over to them after 10 minutes.
All right.
So there are a great many issues that are addressed in the briefs and addressed just now, but the court really only needs to reach a few of them. First, there's no First Amendment infringement in giving effect to plaintiff's own authorization to pay dues, and any prospective relief claim in connection with that issue is moot. And second, exclusive representation collective bargaining does not infringe plaintiffs' First Amendment rights, as every circuit to reach the issue has held and as the Supreme Court held in Knight. But I want to take a step back because we've been talking a bit about the facts here. Plaintiff never paid—
What distinguishes this case from Janus?
So Janus is about whether the state can, by operation of law, require people who have never joined the union, who have never authorized the payment of dues, can require those people to have money deducted from their paychecks through an opt-out system where their consent to those payments is presumed. And Janus has nothing to say about people who affirmatively decided to become union members and instructed their employer to deduct dues from their paycheck affirmatively.
Was this a choice that was available to Mr. Hendrickson, or was it de facto essentially foisted upon him?
It was not foisted upon him at all. Both just in terms of looking at the summary judgment record, which we have as undisputed facts in this case, and as a matter of law. This choice is not foisted upon him at every moment of his membership, which actually goes back to 2003 to 2004. He had the choice whether to be a union member or not. And part of being a union member was agreeing to pay dues. And plaintiff, you know.
So it was not a term of condition of his employment that he be a union member.
That's correct. That's correct. He chose that. He actually, as the summary judgment record shows, he signed and he signed an authorization to have the union recognized as the exclusive representative of his bargaining unit with the state back in 2003. He signed his first union membership card in 2004. He was quite an active member, as the record shows, and was in fact on the bargaining unit against this in collective, excuse me, on the bargaining committee in collective bargaining against the state, and continued to exercise his rights of membership. He signed a new membership card in 2007. Counsel's comments about the coercion there are allegations in the complaint that are not in the summary judgment record, and should for that reason be disregarded. And he signed another authorization in 2017. And in exchange for those authorizations, he received those benefits of membership, which he in fact exercised.
And one other question, and that is, come December of, let's see, last year, I guess, did he opt out then of no longer being a union member?
Yeah, so what he did was, the first time the union became aware that he wanted to resign his membership was when he filed this lawsuit. That was November 30th of 2018. And his—
So that would be 18.
Yeah, 2018.
So yeah. As of 18, he was no longer a union member.
Correct. As soon as he filed the lawsuit and the union became aware of his desire to resign membership and terminate his dues deductions, he was let out of membership and his dues deductions were terminated.
The effect of anything we could do would basically be to, at best, refund partial dues for 2018.
Yeah, plaintiff has his prayer for relief calls for a refund of dues paid to the union while he was a member, but he never paid any amount that he did not authorize. And so enforcing or giving effect to his authorization doesn't infringe any First Amendment right. It's the equivalent to the Supreme Court's holding in Cohen v. Coles Media. Parties can impose obligations upon themselves, and those obligations can be given effect without infringing the First Amendment rights. And it's just the same as the Ninth Circuit held in Belgao and the Third Circuit held in Fisher, which we submitted earlier this week, and in Oliver. And we would encourage the court to agree with the Ninth Circuit and the Third Circuit on these issues.
So, counsel, just to be clear on the timeline here, my understanding is that he did notify the state agency about withdrawing his Ask Me membership in August of 2018, but he continued to pay or his dues continued to be deducted. Why wouldn't he be regarded as a non-member at that point and be able to recover those dues, just as non-members shouldn't, under Janus, have to pay the agency fee?
So he didn't actually attempt to resign his union membership in August of 2018. If you take a look at the record, Your Honor, and this is in the appellee's supplemental appendix at 110, what plaintiff did in August of 2018 was he sent an email to the state personnel office and he said, when can full members resign and stop their dues deductions? And he didn't contact the union. That's undisputed fact in the summary judgment record. He didn't say, I want to resign and terminate my dues deductions right now. He said, when can full members terminate their dues deductions? And the state personnel office responded, in effect, full members can terminate their dues deductions in the December window period. The union heard nothing from plaintiff until he filed this lawsuit against the union, several months later, which happened to be at the beginning of the window period when dues deductions could be terminated, and therefore they were terminated.
So do you argue mootness?
Yes. So plaintiff has raised, he's seeking to enjoin the future operation of the union's dues deduction agreements with respect to the revocation period. But this has zero effect on plaintiff because his dues deductions have already been terminated. And the only way they could ever resume is if he were to reauthorize those deductions and rejoin the union. And there's no realistic likelihood that the union could in any way seek to have the state take the deductions from his wages under any other circumstance. And his suggestion that there should be some kind of prospective relief because it might affect the world at large is just not at issue here because this is a single plaintiff case. It's not a class action. The only person with any interest at stake here is plaintiff himself, and he has no realistic risk of any future harm.
How does Ex parte Young come into play?
I would like to defer that issue to the state's counsel, if I may.
That's fine.
And the only other point I wish to just briefly address before I turn it over to the state is this mistake of law question.
Well, you have 15 seconds to do so.
Okay. The more salient authority here is not Bunner. It is the Brady case and the Fisher case and Belgao and Oliver. The issue in Bunner, which I think the court clearly understands, is that the bargain that the parties actually struck fell apart when the offense that plaintiff had pleaded to was no longer a crime. The difference with our case that makes it more like Brady is, or Koltek, Fisher, U.S. v. Porter in this court, the difference here is that what the parties agreed to was lawful at the time, and it was complete at the time, and it continues to be so today. And with that, I'd like to turn it over to Mr. Marcus.
Thank you. Mr. Marcus?
Thank you. Thank you, Your Honors. Larry Marcus on behalf of the state defendants or state appellees. So first off, I just want to say that the state appellees are fully aligned with the union regarding both the issue of the revocability period regarding the and regarding the difference between this case and Janus, as well as the issue of the exclusive representation. So we're in alignment with the counsel for the union on that. But in addition, we are arguing that the state defendants are not the proper defendants. And Your Honor, you brought up Ex parte Young a minute ago. Ex parte Young, of course, is the exception to the 11th Amendment, which allows the bringing of a claim for prospective relief against the state official in his official capacity. However, in order for that exception to apply, that state official has to be able to do something, has to be able to take some action to provide some redress for the plaintiff's claimed grievances. And in this case, neither the governor nor the attorney general could actually take any, there's nothing that the court can order the governor or the attorney general to do regarding the exclusive representation. The exclusive representation is part of the PEBA, the Public Employees Bargaining Act, and the PEBA is not enforced by the public employees, is not enforced by the governor or the attorney general. Most statutes would be enforced by the governor or the attorney general. So in most cases, if you're trying to declare a statute to be unconstitutional, it would be the governor and the attorney general that you would file a lawsuit to enjoin them from enforcing the statute that you believe to be unconstitutional. But in this case, the statute is not enforced by the governor or the attorney general. It's enforced by the Public Employees Labor Relations Board, the PELRB. And it is those individuals, is those those board members who, they're the ones who certify the exclusive representative. They're the ones who, they handle the negotiations. If there's a dispute regarding who the exclusive representative is, it's the PELRB that handles all of those issues. And
well, counsel, could you just address why isn't it enough to sue the governor under Ex parte Young, given that the governor appoints the members of the board and also is the elected official responsible for the New Mexico Human Services Department, which employed Mr. Hendrickson, and also the state personnel office, which, as I understand it, carries out the dues deduction through the payroll system. Why isn't that enough to bring the governor in?
Because the well, the governor appoints the members of the PELRB. She does so under a very constrained system. One member is selected by the labor unions. One is selected by employers, by state agencies, and one is selected or other public employers, and the other is selected by the other two. And so the governor just sort of goes along with it. I don't want to say she's quite a rubber stamp, but in many ways she is in this case. And she absolutely cannot fire these individuals. These individuals serve a fixed term, and the governor has no firing ability. And this is by design, to keep the board as a neutral arbiter between labor and management. And you can't have management having too much control over it. Otherwise, the whole system doesn't work. It's not no longer neutral. And the PEL are, and the state personnel office and the human services department, they weren't the ones who certified the AFSCME as the exclusive representative for that bargaining unit. They do deduct the dues, but that's a strictly ministerial action. And they do that when the labor union gives them a list and tells them to deduct these dues. And they wouldn't otherwise even find out about it unless the labor union, they wouldn't even find out if someone withdrew unless the labor union told them. So they are, all of these individuals in this regard, they're essentially rubber stamps here. And so they are not the proper defendants. They cannot be ordered to do anything that would change anything for the
They could be ordered not to deduct the dues.
Ordered not to deduct the dues for who though? For any, it would only be people who the labor union said are no longer members of the union. So you'd have to order the labor union not to provide these names to the Human Services Department. But once the names are, it's not the job of the Human Services Department or the State Personnel Office to figure out whether someone should have been allowed to quit the union earlier. That would not be within what they're legally authorized to do.
Mr. Marcus, if I may, please. Judge Matheson, if I may as well. Is this action brought by Mr. Hendrickson collectively on behalf of others, or what's the nature of the representation?
No, Your Honor, it is not collective. He brought it on his own behalf.
Then why isn't this case moot?
It is moot. I think it's moot. I agree with you. Has
there been a jurisdictional motion on this case?
It was part of the both the motion to dismiss and the motion for summary judgment in the
district court. All right. Thank you. Well, let's hear from your colleague, and if you'll add a minute and 19 seconds to his time, please, Mr. Hiram.
Thank you very much, Your Honors.
Thank you. You may proceed, Mr. Kelsey.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. A couple of facts to clear up because they relate directly to your last mootness question. Just to go back, he started working for the state in 2001. His department unionized in 2003. Then he left, worked for another department. He did not join in 2003. He left, came back to work, and that's when the 2006-2007 issue that I mentioned regarding coercion came up. But the more important fact on mootness, Your Honor, is the fact about what he did in August of 2018. So this was now 2 months or a month and a half after the Janus decision, but before his 2-week escape window period came open in December of 2018.
Yes, but if Ms. Goldsmith is correct, and we have to join issue here at these points, because I just don't want to waste our time if this is a serious problem. She says that really it wasn't until December, after the time the open window had come into play, that you did anything affirmatively to notify the defendants in this case that you didn't want to be a union member anymore, and that was the filing of your lawsuit. But by then, you could have elected not to be a member anyway under the open window of that was available to you. And I just don't see why the case isn't moot from the get-go.
Well, Your Honor, it's not moot because
you don't purport to bring this case on behalf of others.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Well, you don't do so in a representative capacity. You filed a lawsuit in your own name.
That's correct, Your Honor. And so back in August 2018, he sent one email. And in that email that you can read in the record, it references an earlier email, which neither party has anymore. But he notified his employer, who was the one who was actively taking the dues from his paycheck. And it was up to them to notify the union that they were stopping the deduction. They did not do that because they were following the New Mexico statute, which is still on the books today. So it is his claim for money damages.
Let me interrupt. I've got the email right in front of me, and there isn't any record evidence of a prior email, so we can only speculate to that. But he says, "Good afternoon, Sandy. I seem to have lost your response regarding full union members. Are we able to withdraw as full members now, or do we have to wait for a certain amount of time? Thank you ahead of time for your response." I mean, that's an inquiry. It's not a, "I want to quit the union, stop deducting dues."
Because he had asked already that he had asked to stop deducting dues. But the answer that was given is
very clear. No, it doesn't say that. It doesn't say I asked before to stop deducting dues. It says I seem to have lost your response regarding full union members. We have no idea. All we know is it was regarding full union members.
Well, respectfully, Your Honor, that's not the record on summary judgment. The record is that, as Ms. Goldsmith said, the record is that there was no direct communication made to the union. But no one has claimed in this case that he never requested to resign in August 2018 from the state. And that because of that money damages claim, that's why this statute is still not
here. Irrelevant whether anybody has claimed it. The point is that you have to have said, I want to quit. I want my money back. Your client didn't do that until this lawsuit was filed. And by then was really an academic exercise. He had the right to withdraw from the union as a matter of right under the terms of his contract, irrespective of anything that Janus may have said on the subject.
Well, the reason why I say it is relevant, Your Honor, is because it must be in the summary judgment record that they're disputing that fact that we have put into our First Amendment complaint, and that's not in there. So that's not moot because it's a claim for money damages, if I may finish this one point. And because of that claim for money damages, that is why wrapped into that, you necessarily have to make a decision as to whether New Mexico Statute 10-7E-17 is constitutional, which is the statute that allows for these escape window time periods. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Ms. Goldsmith, you're saved by the bell. You have 22 seconds. It's what your colleague here has run over, so you've got 22 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor. I would just respond that the first amended complaint allegations really wash out at this point because we have a summary judgment record, and I would encourage the court to look at the summary judgment record. Thank you. I have nothing further.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you, counsel. The case is well argued. Thank you. The case is submitted. Counsel are excused.